Thank you, Lee. I want to talk this morning a little bit about reducing conditions and how we can go about documenting those. And of course, you know, what we're really talking about is anaerobiosis, electrochemical reduction, which is an important component. It's part of the definition of hydric soils and wetlands. It's critical to many of the functions that go on in wetland systems. And so there's obviously a desire to be able to document that. Sometimes, however, that can be challenging. And so I want to talk about some of the methodology that's been used and some of the sort of strengths and weaknesses of the approaches and maybe talk a little bit about some things that have developed a little more recently. So I know we're dealing with sort of restored and natural wetlands from the natural standpoint. You know, for long-term assessments, we've used soil hydromorphology, which really is just looking at the morphological features that develop in soils and using those to help us interpret the hydrological conditions. There's a lot of work that's gone on this for the last half century. But it's useful in giving a sense about the general case. It integrates long-term trends on orders of decades or centuries or even millennia. But it doesn't, and as a result, these are applied in many of the things like the field indicators of hydric soils, because these properties are sort of captured in the soils, and they're useful even when the soil's not wet. But it doesn't really tell us anything about what's going on at the moment. And so that's really all I'm going to say about that, because I really want to focus this morning on things that give us more of an assessment of current conditions. And these sorts of things can be applied both in natural and mitigated sites. There's sort of, I would say, four general ways that we tend to go about making these assessments that can be done by measuring particular chemical species, the activities of chemical species, and calculating things using thermodynamic approaches, use of indicator dyes, redox potentials, and then iris technology. And so I'm going to talk most about these, but really I'm not going to say much about measuring activity. It's hard. It's complicated. It takes a lot of time. Some people do it. You can get some good information. But it's usually very involved. And so some of these other techniques give us sort of a more general way to approach this. So these others are the ones I'm going to talk about today. So when we say indicator dyes, mostly we in sort of the wetland soils community are thinking about the use of alpha-alpha dipyridyl dye, which is a dye that reacts with ferrous iron to give a pink color. It's very distinctive. And the intensity of the color that we see is often related to the activity of concentration of the ferrous iron that's in solution. This, one of the strengths of the method is that it tells you what's going on at the moment. And one of the limitations of the method is it tells you what's going on at the moment. You know, it's really a snapshot, right? So it tells you what's happening today. It doesn't tell you what's happening, you know, over the last month necessarily. But nevertheless, it's useful. We'll see similar limitations, of course, strengths and limitations with measuring redox potentials. Here's an example of some soil extracted from a wet soil. The alpha-alpha dipyridyl dye is applied. This very intense magenta color emerges and lets us know that we have some significant amounts of ferrous iron present. And I say it can be done on sort of a semi-quantitative basis. Sometimes we apply it to the soil. You can also apply it to pore water extracted from the soil. And when you're looking at the water, does this light work here? Good. Yeah. When you're looking at the water, you can detect as little as a half a part per million iron, ferrous iron in solution using these dyes. So it's fairly quite sensitive. Although, when you get up into higher concentrations, it's a lot less sensitive. But it gives you sort of a general a sense. Now, when we're looking at applying it to the soil, it becomes, that's a little bit more obscured, and you really need, you know, maybe approaching 3 parts per million in a light gray soil material like this. However, you can imagine if you start working in dark-colored soils, and many of our wetland soils are enriched in carbon or dark-colored, then the color becomes a little more difficult to evaluate. And so, one of the things that has emerged really, I don't know if it's maybe the last 10 years or so, are the use of these impregnated papers. They're really, they have the alpha-alpha dipyridyl dye that's impregnated in the paper. They're stored dry. You basically push them on moist soil that's freshly extracted in the field, and they turn pink if the ferrous iron's present. And one of the pros is that, you know, these papers, they're stored dry. They've got a nice long shelf life. They're also very useful to use in dark-colored soils, because if you apply the dye to the dark-colored soil, you may not see the pink color, but if you apply this white strip as the soil moisture wicks into the paper, you get this pink color, it's more visible. They're very convenient, easy to use. The cons, I don't really know much about the cons. Maybe the cost. And this is true for using dyes in general, whether the strips you can get false positives if you use a steel tool and you look at a scraped face and that happens to be the face. You just look at a broken interior face and you can avoid those kinds of problems. Now, every time after I mention these, always somebody emails me and says, well, where can I get them? So this is sort of an unabashed ad. I don't get any feedback or kickbacks from these guys. This is the company that I use where they're manufactured. And it gives you some of the specs on them. But more important maybe is this site, which is where you can buy them. And they're listed here. You get 200 strips for $36. Is that too much? I don't know. You can use a piece of one. You know, sometimes when I'm handing out to students, I'll cut them into small pieces and use multiple ones to check it. It's easy. It's useful. And so CTL Scientific Corp, they told me they'd give me $10 for each box they sold after this. So that's dyes. Measuring redox potential with EH, with platinum electrodes, has sort of been a standard, I guess you'd say, in wetlands research for a while. Basically, it involves using some kind of a reference electrode in conjunction with a platinum-tipped electrode with a voltmeter to measure voltages. You measure the voltage, and you have a correction factor that's involved depending on what reference you're using. If it's calomel, it's about 244. If it's silver chloride, it's like 199. And you get a reading, that's EH. You convert it to PE pretty simply if you want to. However, over the years, some of us have made measurements using sort of what I'll call low-cost multimeters. And I won't bore you with the long story, but there's issues associated with these because these instruments that you buy at Radio Shack for $40 are really relatively low-resistance instruments. And so, whereas the research grade, like a pH meter, EH pH meter, has gigaohm magnitude of resistance, these are like 10 megaohms. And so it's several orders of magnitude more resistance. And when you make these measurements with the low resistance meters, if you document these, you get significant drift over time. And we used to think, well, we want to let it drift as far as possible so that we can, you know, the further it drifts, the closer it is to the correct reading. But what we really know now is the correct reading is the one you get at time zero. So the further you let it drift, the worse it is. And the point is it drifts very quickly. And so even within 1 minute, you can have drifts of as much as 75 or 100 millivolts away from the original reading. So you don't want to use a low resistance instrument. You got to use a high resistance instrument. If you buy them off the shelf from some scientific supplier, it's going to cost you $700 or $1,000 for these. And so we also found that for about $15 worth of materials, you can turn a $40 meter into a research-grade instrument. And basically, the brains are a little $2 amplifier, which produces a teraohm magnitude of resistance. And so you get very good readings. They don't drift. And they're comparable to the other. This is public. You know, it's pretty. You just get a student that can. There's a little bit of wiring skills. You can put this together pretty easily. One of the other factors in this is actually using platinum electrodes. If you buy them from a scientific supply house, you can drop $100 a pop on a platinum electrode. We have made hundreds and hundreds of these things over the years. We basically take a solid core copper wire, drill a hole, put in the platinum wire, crimp it, seal it with epoxy. And about 95 or 98% of the cost of this electrode is in the platinum wire. And if you use a half a millimeter wire, you can get by with less than $10, you know, for the platinum, and that's almost the cost, and then, you know, some student time. If you want to use a sturdier 1 millimeter wire, you get four times the mass, and it's four times the cost, and they become a little more expensive. But this way you can use multiple electrodes, which we'll see is actually pretty important. Now, these are some data. These are some example data that I grabbed. The blue lines are replicate electrodes measured at 12 centimeters, and the red lines are on the same plot at 40 centimeters over a couple of months. Once a week, we went out and made these measurements. And the lower graph is the same data set, but just with means and standard error bars. And what we're trying to show here is that in the field, when you're making measurements with multiple electrodes, you're still going to have significant variations in the measurements. I mean, there's just an error that's associated with variability, microsites within the soil. You really can't get around this very well. I guess you could use more electrodes and you'd have a more confined zone where you had confidence interval. But I say, you know, 50 to 150 millivolts is pretty standard for the kinds of errors that you get when measuring these in the field. Now, if you bring this into the lab, let's say you work in a mesocosm, and these are instances where we homogenize the soil material, put it in a mesocosm in the lab, and we get better replication, right? The range is smaller, but there's still, even in those settings, there's enough microvariability that it becomes significant. And, of course, I guess if you were using it in a stirred reactor, that would become more minimized, right? There's less variability in that kind of a system. But just something to keep in mind, because when we go to try to make interpretations of these, we typically use diagrams that look something like this, where we've based on the thermodynamics and the free energies, we can calculate, you know, where the stability fields are for different phases. And we usually like to plot them as thin little lines on here. And in principle, they are thin lines. And I've shown just some examples of different minerals, sulfides and iron oxides and manganese oxides. This is the oxidizing reducing line from the National Technical Committee. But in fact, the soils are complicated. You get mixed potentials. In a paper that we just published, or a chapter with Pat McGonigal, well, we included a diagram that's more like this, that sort of shows these as fields across which some of these things occur. So we, especially when you sort of combine the variability within the soil and the variability in the measurements, I'd be a little bit loath to kind of be too precise in our interpretations here. We want to think of these as zones, and you get useful information, but there's limitations here. So the pros of making redox measurements is they've got a theoretical foundation. It tells you what's going on right now. It's sort of an assessment of what's happening at the moment. You have the problems are the cons. You got lots of microsites that produce variability in your measurements, especially in the field. Sometimes the instrumentation can be a little finicky. And if you install these electrodes for long periods of time, sometimes there's deterioration of the electrodes, and electrodes will go bad. Typically, when we do long-term studies in mesocosms or whatever, you know, we're continually sort of replacing electrodes as they go bad. There's difficulties in interpretation related to mixed potentials in the soil. So you don't want to be hanging your hat too carefully on these redox lines on the EH-pH diagrams. So let me take a few minutes to talk about IRIS technology. This has come on in the last decade or so. It's an acronym for Indicator of Reduction in Soils. The idea originally came from Byron Jenkinson, PhD work he did at Purdue University. And then we've done a lot of follow-up work on it. But the basic principles are you go out into a soil, you create a pilot hole using a push probe. Then you can take your IRIS tube, you insert the IRIS tube down into the hole, you leave it in place during a time when the soil's anaerobic. While it's anaerobic, the microbes are active, they're oxidizing carbon, they're looking for places to dump electrodes, and so the alternative acceptors in an anaerobic system, they eventually find the iron-on oxides on the tubing. As they use that, the iron gets reduced, the paint then dissolves because the reduced iron goes into solution, and then these zones where the paint's been removed can be measured, documented, and it's take that as data. To make the tubes, we just put our tubes on some sort of a lathe device, paint them with an iron oxide paint. We use standard schedule 40 half-inch tubing. We buy the environmental grade so it doesn't have the black printing all over it, which interferes a little bit with interpreting. If you're really hard up and bored, we have a 36-minute video on how to paint iris tubes that I give you the URL to, but it's not hard once you've done it a little bit. The first few are a little bit rough, but one of my students who had painted thousands of tubes is on this, and we have a conversation. So if you're actually interested in doing this, it would be worth probably watching the video. One of the big issues if you make these is making the paint in a way that sticks. The short story is you need, although it's dominantly ferrihydrite, you need to have a certain minimum amount of goethite that forms in order to create a paint that will stick and adhere to the tube and won't rub off commonly with handling. what we've concluded is that in order to get up to this good quality paint, you need about 40% Gerdtite in the ferrihydrite mix. It's just sort of pragmatically. And when we make it, we titrate this to a pH 12, and then by the time we sort of dialyze it and let it sit in the lab, somewhere between about a week or 2 weeks is necessary, because this the Gerdtite's forming as the ferrihydrite's transforming, and you get reach it to a point that the paint, as you try it, will stick. That's always the best. That's the test, right? Paint it a few, see how it works before you paint too many, so you don't do what we did in the early days and, you know, paint 100 of them and throw them all in the trash can because the paint wasn't any good. There's actually some visible differences that you can see with the paint, and I sort of tried to show this schematically. These are three tubes that are good, and these are three tubes that are bad, and you can see the bad ones are a little too red. That's because they're a little too high in ferrihydrite. As you increase the amount of Gerdtite, they get progressively yellow, and we want to shoot for this sort of 40 to 60% Gerdtite range is the optimal, because Gerdtite, you know, it's got different thermodynamic properties. The ferrihydrite reduces a little more easily, and so to get, you know, you want to sort of operate within a similar range. So somebody sent me these, and it's like, because they were having trouble, and as I opened it up, I looked at them, and before I even touched them, I could tell they were problematic from the color. And just a little bit of practice, you'd be able to recognize that. So we usually put these in the soil with multiple tubes. We replicate them just because, again, soil, especially in the field, there's a lot of natural variability. You put one tube in, there's no telling what it really needs. It's like putting in one platinum electrode, right? There's a fair amount of variability in these. Typically, we leave them in for about a month. And then when they come out, you have tubes that look like something like this. And you have to document, you know, how much of this paint has been removed in order to interpret those. Originally, we would just photograph them and rotate them and composite the photos like this and then make estimates or calculations. For our research work, my brother, who can do all things, gave me the courage to take a saw to a flatbed scanner and create this thing so we could scan these images and get images that are sort of unroll the tube into a two-dimensional image and use image analysis to do the calculations. We tried doing visual assessments, you know, comparing what we see to the charts, and people just don't do that great. That's the bottom line. Visual, some people do better than others. Some people are really bad when they make these assessments. The average error on this is about 9% across this range, and so what we ended up, we were just trying, well, what's an easy way? You don't need some fancy scanner to get it in. Sort of, this is old technology, but if you just wrap a grid around it and you mark the places where there are, the bottom line is you come back and you get a pretty good relationship between the measured with the instrument and using the grids. So something that's much more tolerable. So you can be pretty confident. We had 7 students do this and they came up with good replication independently. In terms of interpreting it, there's different sort of ways to approach this, but basically the more paint you have removed, every place where the paint is being removed, you know that you've got some iron being reduced. And we were comparing this to measurements in the soil with redox electrodes. And basically, where we had 10% removed, you know, we had about an 80% confidence that the soil was in fact reduced based on the redox electrodes, 20%, 90%, and et cetera. By the time we got up to 25% removal from the zone within the tube, you know, this was corresponding to soils that we put in the redox electrodes. We were getting measurements below the technical standard line for the National Technical Committee. So different ways to go about interpreting that. So this is just a scale. The one thing I just want to follow up with is, you know, a lot of people have talked about what about alternate paints, like with manganese oxides. And I know there's people that are working on this. I spent some time working on it. The big problem with the manganese paints is getting it to stick to the tube. This is a paper, this is from published by Cindy Stiles and some others a few years back, where they had made some of these tubes and stuck them in soils up in Alaska. And from a thermodynamic standpoint, they're useful. You know, the manganese reduces before the iron, and you get additional information. The big limitation yet, I think, is getting to paint somehow to get the manganese oxide to stick well enough on the tube to give us to make them useful, and we can transport them. All right, they can also be useful sulfides, but I'm running out of time on that, so I'll just say that we can put these in for relatively short periods of time in marshes, and because of this quick chemical reaction between the sulfide and the iron oxides, we can get a very interesting data. We can actually quantify this and demonstrate the differences. It's a little, getting the quantification off of these tubes is a little bit more difficult because the black color actually fades. You know, it's very labile in an aerobic environment. In a matter of minutes to hours, you know, this fades. So just to wrap up, dyes are pretty easy to use. They've got a limited range of reduction because they're just documenting the iron reduction, right? That's what that tells you. EH, of course, is more versatile. It covers a much broader range of reducing conditions in wetlands. Also a little more complicated, a little more to go wrong, but you still, it gives you a snapshot of what's going on today. Iris, a lot of sort of practitioners like the use of iris tubes because they're easy to use. You put them in, you leave them for a month, you pull them out, they're stable, you can make your interpretations. Again, at this point, the iron ones are focused, you know, are limited to that the documentation of reduction of iron. If we had tubes that reduce manganese, that would give us maybe additional information. But anyway, these are they're fairly useful, and they have a lot of benefits in that way. So with that, I'll stop, and thank you for your attention this morning.
Thank you, Marty.
Marty, just a quick question. I had some people warned me that there was some toxicity issue with the alpha-alpha dipyridyl, that students need to wear gloves or something of the sort. Is that a real concern?
Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know the level of toxicity. I've heard. I mean, I wouldn't drink it, and I would probably not. I would probably not, or take some care not try not to get it on my skin unnecessarily. But I don't think it has highly, you know, toxic warnings. I mean, I think I've looked at the MD materials data safety sheets. But they're not things like phenol, you know, these nasty. Yeah.
So for those iris tubes, if you use them in a mesocosm study, how stable is the iron coating on that tube? Or could you see, like, if you put it into an acidic soil, could you see some of that iron, come into the soil solution and then influence maybe what you're looking at in your study?
I guess that's a good question. I mean, these are iron oxides, and so the solubility at the pHs, you know, we normally see in soils 4.5 to 6.5, in the east 4.5 to 6.5. You know, I think the solubility is pretty low. Unless the soil becomes reducing, we can't measure it. You know, at least in looking at the tube, we don't see any significant loss. Now, if you're looking at some trying to measure, you know, iron reactions or microbes dealing with iron, then, you know, sticking an iron-coated tube in the system probably, could have some influence. So I don't know that I'd advocate that, but, good question.
I've got a question for you. How do you, when you actually remove them, what do you do to avoid loss and scraping and actually affecting the surface of the tube?
Okay, so that's a pretty practical question. And what we would say is that, you know, when we insert them, we like them, it's best to put it in a moist soil. And of course, the sandier the soil, the more potential for abrasion. But if you make a pilot hole, they usually go in pretty well. Hopefully you're using a probe that's the same dimension or just slightly larger than the tube, so you can insert it without a lot of abrasion. Once they've been in the soil for a month, if it's been a wet or moist soil, then that soil will tend to, you know, be right up against, you want it to be right up against the tube. So if it's a sand, if it's a fine textured soil, the abrasion is usually fairly minimum if the paint is good. If it's a coarse textured soil, it's more of an issue. So sometimes, you know, we'll gently sort of rock the tube a little bit to kind of loosen it before, you never want to twist it, right? Because twisting would be accentuating the abrasion, right? But if you rock it a little bit and just pull it straight up, if the soil's dry, it probably would be a good idea to try to moisten the soil if you're concerned about abrasion. But usually you can recognize abrasion and differentiate it from the other removal because it's got, you know, a long linear orientation along the length of the tube. So those aren't usually too hard to differentiate.
Okay. Mike.
The only other thing I'd comment on is, what about using the IRIS tubes for reconnaissance, what I call reconnaissance? In other words, you've got a site far away, you don't know if it's a wetland or not, you just, instead of investing a lot of money with daily or weekly, you know, you just stick a couple of these tubes in the ground, come back 6 months later or whatever. If the iron's gone, okay, maybe more work needs to be done there. If it's all red, forget it.
Perfect. That's exactly what I would help you.
Okay, that's the response I want from you every time I ask a question or make a statement.
Yeah, just for a matter of time, I didn't take time to, but I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's a very useful tool in that regard, too. And, you know, typically we say, you know, we deploy these for a month when we're trying to document reducing conditions. But sometimes, you know, you can put them in for long, and because the removal tends to be cumulative, so over a longer period, the longer they're in, the more paint will likely to be removed. And this is why we say, we call them reconnaissance work, because if you stick them in for 6 months or a year, you know, if there's no removal or little removal, you know there's no hydric soil there. But if there's been sufficient removal that, you know, you got a lot of paint removed, you don't know whether that happened within a month or whether it was much more gradual, and so that's why additional work would probably need to be done. But good point. Thank you, Mike.
Any other questions? Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. We love iris tubes. We know.
What is sufficient removal, say, in a month for a hydric soil?
Well, if you would like to get approval from the National Technical Committee for Hydric Soils, they are looking for at least 30% removal over a 15-centimeter zone that occurs somewhere within the upper 30 centimeters. Okay, that's the way the technical standard is documented, if you're familiar with the National Hydric Soil Technical Commander, technical standard. You know, we've done some other work that has some slightly different thresholds on that, but I think it's, you know, where you get these splotches that are being removed, you can be pretty confident that there's reduction going on in that zone. And the degree is to sort of how extensive is that within the soil zone in order for it to be considered reducing. And from, like I said, the data we said, once you get 25% or so removal, you can be very confident that this is a dominantly reducing system. You know, if you get, you know, 10 to 20%, you know, surely there's something going on, and there's pockets and there's zones within there that are reducing. But there's a continuum there. I mean, there's a continuum. The more removal, the more reducing. It also, I should say, is because this is a microbial process, right? When we put the tubes in the marsh and they turn black, that's a quick chemical reaction. That happens almost instantaneously. The longer they're in, the darker they get. The higher the concentration, the darker they get. And it's a fast chemical reaction. The removal of the iron oxides from the tubes is a microbially mediated reaction. And so it's a much slower reaction. It's also temperature dependent. And so commonly when we're doing work in soils, we'll install them throughout. We'll put them in for a month. But let's say we'll put them in March 1, then we'll pull them and replace them on April 1, then we'll pull them and replace them on May 1. Because it's progressively getting warmer, and what the amount that's removed is going to be an interaction between being, you know, how saturated it is and how warm it is, how active the microbes are, and so that's all sort of interacting together. So it is a continuum, and but those are the processes. Sorry.
Would the interpretation of the ISIS tubes be different at all for like acidic versus very alkaline soils?
Well, we wouldn't try to correlate it directly to EH, right? But we do know that the EH at which iron oxides become reduced is a function of pH. But if you get the paint removal from the tube, you're confident that you're below that threshold, whatever the pH is, right? Whether it's pH 4, pH 7.5, right? Yeah, and I don't have it. I haven't actually installed these in marls and some of those places. Some, you know, cases that have, you know, free carbonates and such. You know, that. So I don't know how they perform in those kinds of environments. I don't know. Maybe someone else has put some iron tubes in Karen.
I've done a lot of work with iris tubes in the past, and I recently installed some in the Carrizo Plain here in California, saline vernal pools, and we've had a drought for the last 2 years. There was one season I did catch where it did get wet, and yeah, we're not finding much of any removal from the tubes, which we would think, because it is not reduced with respect to iron.
Is there much carbon in those systems?
Carbonates, yeah.
How about organic carbon?
Oh, no. And that's the question. If I was to spike it with, you know, some carbon, would it work?
Oh, now there's... Because it's microbially driven, right, if you use them in systems that don't have organic carbon, they only function if, you know, the microbes, are, you know, these heterotrophic microbes are looking for electron acceptors to dump electrons as they're oxidizing the carbon, right? So if they're low-carbon systems, it may be
that
they're not reducing because there's not much carbon, more than because, you know, they're high pH.
We'll see.
And this is Karen Vaughn. If you don't know Karen Vaughn, she was an early adopter of iris tubes. We were actually working very closely with Byron Jenkinson at the time that developed those.
I was just going to suggest maybe you put a little glucose into your iris tube and see what happens.
In the tube? Well, you pour it in the paint, and the paint will have trouble. But maybe you could... have a perforated tube and fill your tube with a glucose solution that would sort of seep out. There have been lots of ideas, like maybe paint the, put a candy coating on the iris tube to paint.
Okay, Marty, thank you.